continuously will definitely be able to transform themselves and to attain high realizations. Chapter 18, Spiritual Teachers. Is it necessary to have a spiritual teacher? How do we find one? Having the guidance of one or more qualified spiritual mentors is very helpful. While books can give us information, a teacher is able to answer our questions and provide an example of how to integrate the teachings into our lives. We can have more than one teacher, although one of them usually becomes our principal or root teacher. We are responsible for seeking qualified teachers. This is especially important given that there's such a spiritual supermarket in the West. Not everyone who teaches is a realized being, or even an ethical one. We must get to know teachers before accepting them as our teachers. To do this, we should attend teachings given by various people, observe their behavior, examine the quality of the teachings, and gradually decide. What are qualities that we should look for in choosing a teacher? Qualified teachers act ethically, have sound meditative experience, and correctly understand emptiness. They have also studied the Buddhist scriptures in depth, are able to teach a variety of Dharma subjects, and have a good relationship with their own teachers. They are motivated to teach out of genuine concern for their students, not out of desire for offerings and fame. They are compassionate and patient, and will try to help their students no matter how many mistakes the students may make. They teach in accord with general Buddhist principles and do not alter the meaning of the Dharma in order to gain more students or receive more offerings. Are all Dharma teachers monastics, or can some be lay practitioners? Dharma teachers may be either monastics or lay people. While lay teachers may have families, monastics are always celibate. In choosing teachers, we should see who sets a good example for us and follow those people. How do we relate to our teachers? We benefit from recognizing our teachers' good qualities and treating them with respect, because respecting others opens us to benefit from their guidance. Also, if we provide for our teachers and help them with tasks that need to be done, they will have more time to teach, and we will gain invaluable experience and create positive potential. The most important element in relating to our teachers is to think about and put into practice the excellent teachings they give. Whether we receive Dharma instructions in a large group or privately, they are given to benefit us, and we should try to implement them as best we can. Respecting our teachers and following their guidance doesn't mean allowing ourselves to get into unhealthy relationships with them. Some people talk about surrendering to the spiritual guide. What is to be surrendered is our egocentric, disturbing attitudes and negative emotions, not our wisdom, common sense, and responsibility for our own lives. If a teacher tells us to do something that goes against general Buddhist principles, we should not do it. I have met women who were approached by spiritual teachers for sexual relationships. The women felt unsure of themselves or even guilty when they declined because they thought, "This is a high teacher. Maybe there are reasons for his behavior that I don't understand." Women should not doubt themselves. If they feel uncomfortable, they should say so directly and leave. Other women feel flattered that the teacher is paying attention to them and think they may have a special spiritual experience by having a sexual relationship with him. Going along with this generally leads to disappointment and hurt, and thus should be avoided. In addition, doting on our teachers is inappropriate, as is being possessive of them and jealous of other students. Our teacher's role is to guide us to enlightenment, not to fulfill our emotional needs. Spiritual teachers are not substitutes for parents or therapists. Sometimes our spiritual mentors may point out our faults. They do this out of compassion and to benefit us. At those times, we should examine ourselves and take the opportunity to learn about ourselves. Then we should apply the Dharma teachings to our mind, modify our unproductive ways of thinking, and alter our bad behavior. What can we think and do if we see a spiritual teacher or a monastic act in a way that seems inappropriate to us? We must first develop a constructive attitude ourselves, and then determine a proper course of action. While whitewashing inappropriate behavior is not healthy, becoming indignant and raising a ruckus helps neither ourselves nor others. It's natural to feel disappointed when someone we respect acts in a way that seems unsuitable. But it's important to ask ourselves, am I disappointed and angry because that person isn't what I want them to be? Or am I sad because perhaps that person is having difficulties and needs help? There's a big difference in the two attitudes. The first is self-centered. We are upset because someone we set up as an idol or role model isn't acting in the way we expect and want. The other is compassionate and seeks to benefit the person. We must examine our expectations and try to cultivate the latter attitude. The next step is to think about how best to help in the situation. Each situation is different. In some cases, we can approach the person directly and ask about the behavior. In other situations, we may feel it's best to speak to the person's teacher or to their Dharma friends. Some situations can be resolved quietly. Others may require public discussion. In any case, we should try to cultivate an attitude that is both honest and compassionate, not accusatory or self-righteous. What is an appropriate title to use when addressing our spiritual mentors? What do the terms Lama, Rinpoche, Geshe, Achan, Roshi, and Sensei mean? We may ask our teacher how they prefer to be addressed. Monastics are generally called venerable, although some use the term sister or brother. Achan is a term used in the Theravada tradition indicating someone who is a teacher or a senior monastic. Sensei and Roshi are used in the Japanese Zen tradition, the former meaning teacher, and the latter indicating a certain level of accomplishment in practice. Lama, Rinpoche, and Geshe are found in the Tibetan tradition. Lama may be used under a variety of circumstances. It means teacher, guru, in Sanskrit, and is used for highly respected masters. Other times, it indicates having done a 3-year meditation retreat. Rinpoche may indicate a recognized reincarnation of a spiritual master, or it may be used as a term of respect for one's own teacher. Geshe is an educational degree, comparable to a PhD in Buddhism. It is easy to get lost in titles and to confuse titles with actual accomplishments. In addition, some people like titles and use many of them, although their spiritual accomplishments are few, while others are more modest and refuse to use titles even though they have deep knowledge and experience of the Buddha's teachings. We should never rely on someone's titles, but should check their knowledge and personal qualities before establishing a student-teacher relationship with them. Chapter 19. Family and Children. What does Buddhism say about romantic love and marriage? Romantic love is generally plagued with attachment, which is why many marriages end in divorce. When people fall in love with an image they created of the person instead of with the actual human being, false expectations proliferate. For example, many people in the West unrealistically expect their partner to meet all of their emotional needs. If someone came up to us and said, "I expect you to always be sensitive to me, continuously support me, understand me no matter what I do, and meet all my emotional needs," what would we say? Undoubtedly, we would tell them that we are one limited being. They had the wrong person. In a similar way, we should avoid having such unrealistic expectations of our partners. Each person has a variety of interests and emotional needs. Therefore, we need a variety of friends and relatives to share and communicate with. Nowadays, because people move so often, we may need to work harder to develop several stable, long-term friendships. But doing so strengthens our primary relationship. For a romantic relationship to survive, more than romantic love is needed. We need to love the other person as a human being and as a friend. The sexual attraction that feeds romantic love is an insufficient basis on which to establish a long-term relationship. Deeper care and affection, as well as responsibility and trust, must be cultivated. In addition, we do not fully understand ourselves and are a mystery to ourselves. Needless to say, other people are even more of a mystery to us. Therefore, we should never presuppose, with a bored attitude that craves excitement, that we know everything about our partner because we have been together so long. If we have the awareness of the other person being a mystery, we will continue to pay attention and be interested in him or her. Such interest is one key to a long-lasting relationship. How can Buddhism help our family life? Family harmony is extremely important, and divorce is traumatic for adults and children alike. If adults see the main purpose of marriage as pleasure, then arguments and the breakup of the family come about more easily. As soon as people don't get as much pleasure as they want, discontent sets in, quarrels ensue, and the marriage collapses. Many people go on to have numerous partners, but still fail to find satisfaction. This is a clear example of the way in which clinging to one's own pleasure brings pain to oneself and others. If both partners hold the Dharma as the center of their relationship will be more satisfying. That is, both partners are determined to live ethically and to develop their loving-kindness toward all beings impartially. Then they will support each other to grow and to practice. For example, when one partner becomes discouraged or starts to neglect Dharma practice, the other can help him or her get back on track through gentle encouragement and open discussion. If the couple has children, they can arrange for each other to have time for quiet reflection as well as time with the children. Although raising children is time-intensive, parents should not see this as antithetical to Dharma practice. They can learn a lot about themselves from their children, and they can help each other work through the challenges of parenthood in the light of Buddhist values. Influenced by contemporary trends in psychology, many people have come to attribute most of their problems to childhood experiences. However, if this is done with an attitude of blame, I have problems because of what my parents did when I was a child, it sets the stage for them to feel guilty and fearful that they will damage their own children when they have families. This kind of anxiety is scarcely conducive to healthy child-rearing or to feeling compassion for ourselves. Viewing our childhood as if it were an illness that we have to recover from only damages us as well as our children. Although we cannot ignore detrimental influences from childhood, it's just as important to pay attention to the kindness and benefit we have received from our families. No matter what our situation was when we were growing up, we were the recipients of much kindness from others. Remembering this, we allow ourselves to feel the gratitude that naturally arises for those who have helped us. If we do, we also can pass that same kindness and care on to our children. How can the Dharma help children? How can we teach the Dharma to children? The essence of the Buddha's teaching is to avoid harming others and to help them as much as possible. These are values that both Buddhist and non-Buddhist parents want to instill in their children so that they can live harmoniously with others. Since children learn largely through example, the most effective way for parents to teach their children good values is to live them themselves. Of course, this isn't always so easy. But if parents try to practice well, their children will directly benefit from their example. Growing up with Buddhism in the home helps children. If a family has a shrine, the children can keep it tidy and make offerings. One friend and her 3-year-old daughter bow to the Buddha 3 times every morning. The child then gives the Buddha a present, some fruit or cookies, and the Buddha gives one back to the child, usually the previous day's offering. The little girl loves this ritual. Children like music, and the melodies of prayers, mantras, and Buddhist songs can take the place of the usual commercial jingles and nursery rhymes. Many parents chant mantras to their babies when the infants are upset or sleepy, and the babies react positively to the gentle vibration. In another family I know, the 5-year-old son leads the prayer when they offer their food before eating. These are simple yet profound ways for parents and children to share spirituality. Several Buddhist families could gather together on a weekly or monthly basis to practice together, rather than just taking the kids to Sunday school and letting someone else teach them. Practicing together provides the opportunity for the parents and children to spend some peaceful time together apart from their harried schedules. It also enables Buddhist families to meet and support each other. Activities for young children could include singing Buddhist songs, prayers, and mantras, learning to bow to the Buddha and make offerings at the shrine, and doing a short breathing meditation. Parents and school-age children could role-play together, creating a scene in which all the characters think of their own happiness above others, and then replaying it with one of the characters thinking of others' happiness. Such activities teach children problem-solving and let them see the results of different behaviors. Families could also visit Buddhist temples and centers in the community together. Reading Buddhist children's books and watching Buddhist videos are other activities parents can share with their children. There is an excellent cartoon video of the Buddha's life, and many children's Dharma books. Informal discussions with children can be both amusing and instructive, and parents may be surprised how open their children are to concepts such as rebirth, karma, and kindness to animals. Many parents exclaim, "My child can't sit still." My guess is that these children have seldom seen their parents sit peacefully either. When children see an adult sitting peacefully, they get the idea that they can as well. Sometimes a parent's quiet time can be shared with their children. For example, a child can sit on his or her parent's lap while the parent recites mantras. Other times, parents may want to be undisturbed when they meditate, and children learn to respect their parents' wish for quiet time. Discussion groups work well with teenagers. An adult can facilitate a discussion about friendship or other topics of concern to teenagers. The beauty of Buddhism is that its principles can apply to every aspect of life. The more children see the relevance of ethical values and loving kindness to their lives, the more they will value those traits. Once I led a discussion group for 20 teenagers about boy-girl relationships. Each person spoke in turn, and although they were ostensibly talking about their lives and feelings, there was a lot of dharma in what they said. For example, they brought out the importance of living ethically. As the facilitator, I didn't teach or preach. I just listened and respected what they said. Afterwards, some of them came up to me and said, "Wow, that's the first time we've ever talked about that with a nun." Not only were they able to talk openly in the presence of an adult about a sensitive topic, but they also understood that religious people are aware and sympathetic of teenagers' concerns. In addition, they saw the relevance to their lives. What if our children aren't interested in Buddhism? Should we allow them to go to church with their friends? Religion should not be forced on anyone. If children aren't interested in Buddhism, let them be. They can still learn how to be a kind person from observing their parents' attitudes and actions. Classmates are likely to invite their friends to go to church with them. Because we live in a multicultural and multi-religious society, it's helpful for children to learn about other traditions by attending their friend's church or temple. When they do so, we should prepare them by discussing the fact that people have different beliefs, and thus mutual respect and tolerance are important. Our children can also invite their classmates to a Dharma center or Buddhist activities, thus promoting mutual learning and respect. How can we introduce children to meditation? Children are often curious when they see their parents do their daily meditation practice. This can be an opportunity to teach them a simple breathing meditation. Children enjoy sitting quietly alongside their parents for 5 or 10 minutes. When their attention span sags, they can quietly get up and go in another room while the parents continue to meditate. If parents find this too disturbing, they can do their daily practice privately and meditate together with their youngsters at another time. Children can also learn visualization meditation. Most children love to pretend and can easily imagine things. Parents can teach their children to imagine the Buddha, made of light. Then, while light radiates from the Buddha into them and all the beings around them, they can chant the Buddha's mantra. If a child has a sick relative, friend, or pet, or if a friend is having problems, the child could visualize that person specifically and imagine the Buddha sending light to him or her. In that way, children increase their compassion and feel involved in helping those they care about. Dharma centers usually schedule events for adults, and no child care is provided. What can we do? Dharma centers need to gradually expand their range of activities. Parents who are members could meet together and discuss how to do this, utilizing some of the suggestions above. They then can organize family activities or activities for children at the centers. How can we have good relationships with our children, especially when they're teenagers? Having an open relationship with teenagers is important, and this depends on how the parents relate to their children when they're small. This, in turn, depends on spending time with the children and on having a positive attitude toward them. When parents are harried, they tend to see having children as a hassle, yet another thing to take care of before they collapse after a hard day at work. Children pick up on this, often feeling that their parents don't care about them or don't have time for them even if they care. Setting priorities is essential in building good relationships with children. This may mean accepting a job that pays less but has shorter hours, or turning down a promotion that would have increased family income but meant more stress and less time at home. Love is more important to children than material possessions. Choosing to earn more money at the expense of good family relations may mean later having to spend that extra income on therapy and counseling for both parents and children. Do children need discipline? How do we do that without getting angry? Children often provide the best and the most difficult opportunity to practice patience. For that reason, parents are advised to become familiar with the antidotes to anger that the Buddha taught. Patience doesn't mean letting children do whatever they want to. That is, in fact, being cruel to children, for it allows them to develop bad habits, which makes it more difficult for them to get along with others. Children need guidelines and limits. They need to learn the results of different behaviors and how to discriminate between which to practice and which to abandon. Contentment is an essential Buddhist principle. How can we teach it to children? The attitude of contentment enables us to enjoy life more and experience more satisfaction. I believe one reason children are discontent is that they are given too many choices about their sense pleasures. From a young age, they are asked, "Do you want apple juice or orange juice? Do you want to watch this TV show or that one? Do you want this kind of bicycle or that? Do you want a red toy or a green one?" Children, not to mention adults, become confused by being bombarded with so many choices. Instead of learning to be content with whatever they have, they are constantly forced to think, which thing will bring me the most happiness? What else can I get to make me happy? This increases their greed and confusion. Remedying this doesn't mean that parents become authoritarian. Rather, they place less emphasis on the importance of these things in the home. Of course, this also depends on parents altering the ways they themselves relate to sense pleasures and material possessions. If parents cultivate contentment, their children will find it easier to do so as well. Chapter 20. Shrines and Offerings. What is the purpose of a shrine? What is put on it? People often like to set up a simple shrine in their homes in a clean, quiet place. Images of the Buddhas, Buddhist deities, and bodhisattvas are placed on a shrine as a symbol of the Buddha's enlightened physical forms. Those following Tibetan Buddhism put photos of their spiritual teachers above these. But people from other Buddhist traditions don't necessarily do this. To the Buddha's right, the left side of the shrine as we look at it, is a text representing the Buddha's enlightened speech. To the Buddha's left is a bell or a stupa, relic monument, symbolizing the Buddha's enlightened mind. Various offerings are placed in front of these. The figures on a shrine remind us of the good qualities of the Buddha's Dharma and Sangha, thus inspiring us to develop those same good qualities. Some days we may feel agitated, angry, or depressed. When we pass by a shrine in our homes or visit a temple and see the photos of our spiritual mentors or the peaceful figure of the Buddha, it helps us remember that there are beings who are peaceful, and we can become like them. Automatically, our minds settle down. Do Buddhists worship idols? Not at all. A piece of clay, bronze, or jade is not the object of our respect and worship. For example, if we go to a place far away from our family, we're likely to take a photo of them with us to remember them better. When we look at the photo and feel love for our family, we are not loving the paper and ink of the photo. The photo merely strengthens our memory. It is similar with a statue or painting of the Buddha. When bowing before images of the Buddha, we recall the qualities of the enlightened beings and develop respect for their impartial love and compassion, generosity, ethical conduct, patience, joyous effort, concentration, and wisdom. The statue or painting reminds us of the qualities of the Buddhas, and we bow to those qualities, not to the clay. In fact, having a figure of the Buddha to bow before is not necessary. We can remember the Buddha's qualities and develop respect without it. Showing respect to the Buddhas and their qualities inspires us to develop these extraordinary qualities ourselves. We become like the people we respect. So when we take the loving kindness and wisdom of the Buddhas as our example, we strive to become like them. What is the purpose of making offerings to the Buddhas? We don't make offerings because the Buddhas need them. When someone has purified all defilements and enjoys the bliss that comes from wisdom, He or she certainly doesn't need an apple or an incense stick to be happy. Nor do we make offerings to win the Buddha's favor. The Buddha's developed impartial love and compassion long ago, and won't be swayed by flattery and bribery the way ordinary beings are. Making offerings helps us create positive potential and develop our good qualities. At present, we have excessive attachment and miserliness. We tend to keep the biggest and best for ourselves and give the second best, or something we don't want, to others. But these self-centered attitudes make us feel consistently poor and dissatisfied no matter how much we have. In addition, we fear losing what little we do have. Such attitudes make us restless and lead us to act dishonestly to get more things, or to be unkind to others to protect what we have. One purpose of making offerings is to pacify these harmful emotions of attachment and miserliness. Thus, when making an offering, we try to do so without any feelings of loss or regret. Water is readily accessible so that we can easily offer it without attachment or miserliness. Bowls of water are often offered on the shrine. By offering with a happy mind, we habituate ourselves to the thought and action of giving. Thus, we come to feel rich when we give and take pleasure in sharing good things with others. Some people wonder if the Buddhas actually receive the offerings. A cute story tells of a young monk staying up late to see if the Buddha image in the prayer hall took the offerings in the middle of the night. Don't think that the Buddhas don't receive the offerings just because the flowers and fruit are still on the shrine the next day. They can receive them, enjoying the essence of the offerings without taking them away. Since the Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and Arhats are the highest of all beings, making offerings to them has special meaning. We usually give gifts to our friends because we like them. Here, we make offerings to the holy beings because we are attracted to their qualities. We shouldn't make offerings with the intention to bribe the Buddhas. I offer you incense, now you are obliged to grant my prayers. Rather, we practice giving with a respectful and kind attitude. If we later make a request, we do so with humility. What is offered on the shrine? Anything we consider beautiful can be offered. Traditional offerings are water, flowers, incense, light, perfume, and food. But we can offer other things as well. Those in the Tibetan tradition generally offer 7 bowls of water each morning. The water is removed at the end of the day and thrown in a clean place or sprinkled over flowers and plants, while the empty bowls are placed upside down. Food that is offered should be removed from the shrine before it spoils. We may eat it or give it to others, although food that has been offered on the shrine isn't generally fed to animals. Is there a symbolic meaning to each offering? Yes. Flowers represent the qualities of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Incense, the fragrance of pure ethics. Light symbolizes wisdom, and perfume represents confidence in the holy beings. Offering food is like offering the nourishment of meditative concentration, and music symbolizes impermanence and the empty nature of all phenomena. While we may physically offer one flower, mentally we can imagine the entire sky filled with beautiful flowers and offer these as well. Imagining lovely things and then offering them to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas enriches our mind. Similarly, we can offer things mentally without placing them on the shrine. For example, when we see beautiful things in showcase windows or witness the loveliness of nature, we can mentally offer these to the 3 jewels. This helps us avoid attachment to these things. Do Buddhists say grace before eating? Yes. There is the practice of offering our food before eating. Usually we dive into a plate of food with great attachment, little mindfulness, and even less real enjoyment. Instead, we can pause before eating and reflect on our motivation. Here we think that we are not eating for temporary pleasure or to make our body attractive. Rather, we eat to keep our body healthy so that we can practice the Dharma and benefit all beings. Reflecting on the kindness of those who planted, harvested, transported, and packaged our food, we feel interconnected with them and want to repay their kindness by using the occasion of eating to create positive potential for their benefit. For this reason, we offer the food. Imagine the food as blissful nectar and offer it to a small Buddha made of light in our heart center, chakra. This Buddha represents all the enlightened beings combined with our own Buddha potential. The Buddha enjoys the nectar and radiates light that fills our entire body and makes us very blissful. In this way, we remain mindful of the Buddha as well as of the process of eating. We create positive potential by making offerings to the Buddha, and we also enjoy the food more. Before eating, some people like to recite the verses. To the Supreme Teacher, the Precious Buddha. To the Supreme Practice, the Holy Precious Dharma. To the Supreme Guides, the Precious Sangha. To all the objects of refuge, we make this offering. May we and all those around us never be separated from the triple gem in any of our lives. May we always have the opportunity to make offerings to them. And may we continuously receive their blessings and inspiration to progress along the path. If you are alone or eating with Dharma friends, you may want to pause before eating to do the reflection and visualization and to recite the verses. If you are in a restaurant or with people who are not Buddhist, you don't need to make a display of offering your food. Instead, simply do the reflection, visualization, and offering mentally while the others are getting settled or chatting. Chapter 21. Prayer, Ritual, and Dedicating Positive Potential. What is the role of prayer? Can prayers be answered? There are many kinds of prayers. Some are designed to direct our minds toward a certain spiritual quality or aim, inspiring our mind to work to develop it, and thus creating the cause for us to attain this. An example is praying to be more tolerant and compassionate toward others. Other prayers are for specific people or situations, for example, praying for a person's illness to be cured, or for that person's mind to be peaceful, and his life meaningful in spite of the illness. For any prayer to be fulfilled, prayer alone isn't sufficient. The appropriate causes must also be created. We can't simply think, "Please, Buddha, make this and that happen. I'll relax and have tea while you do the work." For example, if we pray to be more loving and compassionate, and yet make no effort to control our anger, we aren't creating the cause for that prayer to be fulfilled. The transformation of our minds comes from our own effort, but we can pray for the Buddha's inspiration to do so. Receiving the blessings of the Buddhas doesn't mean that something tangible comes from the Buddha and goes into us. It means that our minds are transformed through the combined effort of the teachings, the guidance of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and our own practice. Requesting the Buddha's blessings has the connotation of requesting to be inspired by them so that our minds and actions are transformed and become more beneficial. Some Buddhist practitioners seek to be born in a pure land in their next life because all the conditions there are conducive for Dharma practice and developing wisdom and compassion are comparatively easy. But we cannot pray to be born in a pure land and expect the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to make it happen. We must also make effort to actualize the teachings by not selfishly clinging to worldly pleasures and by generating compassion and an understanding of emptiness. If we do our part, then praying will have a profound effect on our minds. On the other hand, if we make no attempt to correct our harmful habits and if our minds are distracted while we pray, the effect is minimal. Some people pray for another's sickness to be cured, for the family finances to improve, or for a deceased relative to have a good rebirth. For these things to occur, the other people involved must have created the necessary causes. If they have, our prayers provide the condition for the seed of constructive actions they did in the past to ripen into that result. However, if they haven't created the causal seeds through their own positive past actions, it's difficult for our prayers to be fulfilled. We can put fertilizer and water on the ground, but if the farmer hasn't planted the seed, nothing will grow. When the Buddha described the working of cause and effect in our mind streams, he said that killing causes us to have short lives or much illness. Abandoning killing and saving the lives of others causes us to have a long life, free from illness. If we neglect to follow this basic advice and yet pray for a long and healthy life, we have missed the point. On the other hand, if we abandon killing and save lives, prayers can help those positive seeds to ripen. In addition, the Buddha said generosity is the cause of wealth. If we have been generous in a past life and now pray for our wealth to increase, our finances could improve. Yet if we are miserly now, we are creating the cause for poverty, not wealth, in the future. In this case, no matter how much we pray to be financially comfortable, our actions are creating the cause for the opposite result. Instead, we need to cultivate generosity, helping those in need, and sharing what we have. What is the purpose of rituals? Are they necessary? Rituals are designed to help us counteract our disturbing attitudes and destructive actions and to develop our good qualities and positive actions. Rituals are a means, not an end in themselves. Because we are beginners and often have difficulty in distinguishing what to practice and what to abandon on the path, prayers written by advanced practitioners give us guidelines to follow. Saying the prayers can help us tune into the meanings they express. While we read or recite them, we should simultaneously try to meditate and transform our minds into the mental states described in the rituals. When we do a ritual alone, we can pause to concentrate on particular points that touch us deeply. We do not need to limit our prayers to those composed by other people. As we study the Dharma and become familiar with the path to enlightenment, prayers may spontaneously arise in our minds. Events that evoke prayers may occur in our lives, and these can be very helpful in deepening our experience of the Dharma. Some people like rituals and find them useful for their practice. Other people find them distracting. A person may want to do more rituals at certain times and fewer at others. Everyone is unique, and there are no hard and fast rules. We must do what feels comfortable to us, and not do rituals simply because everyone else is doing them. What are some common Buddhist rituals? Rituals found in all Buddhist traditions include turning for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, taking precepts to avoid harmful behavior, praising the qualities of the three jewels, making offerings to them, generating loving kindness toward others, revealing our own mistakes, and rejoicing in the happiness and good qualities of others. In addition to these, each tradition has unique prayers reflecting those aspects of the path it emphasizes. What role does chanting play in our spiritual development? Chanting can be very beneficial if done with a proper motivation, such as to prepare for future lives, attain liberation from cyclic existence, or become a Buddha to benefit others most effectively. For chanting to be effective in generating positive states of mind, we must try to concentrate and reflect upon the meaning of what we chant. Chanting profound prayers with a mind distracted by thoughts of food or work or parties has little effect. A tape recorder could also chant the names of the Buddha and say prayers. But if we transform our thoughts so they correspond to what we're chanting, then chanting becomes very powerful and beneficial. A complete spiritual practice includes more than chanting. Listening to teachings, contemplating and discussing their meaning, and integrating them into our daily life enables us to think, feel, speak, and act in beneficial ways. Chanting alone cannot liberate us from cyclic existence. Deep meditation is necessary to generate the wisdom realizing selflessness. What is the difference between a prayer and a mantra? Is it necessary to chant them in a foreign language that we don't understand? Mantras are prescribed syllables to protect the mind. We want to protect our minds from attachment, anger, ignorance, and so on. Sometimes we seem to have an endless flow of internal chatter, with our mind making comments about what this person is wearing and what that person said. Reciting mantras is a skillful way to transform this tendency for internal chatter, so that instead of commenting on useless, trivial things, we focus our mind on reciting syllables spoken by a Buddha. When combined with the four opponent powers, explained in the chapter on karma, mantra recitation acts as a powerful antidote that purifies negative karmic imprints on our mind streams. While reciting mantras, we train our minds to think, feel, and visualize in beneficial ways, thus building up constructive mental and emotional habits. In addition, recitation of mantras calms our mind and heightens our concentration. Mantras are recited in Sanskrit rather than being translated into other languages because they are the words spoken by a Buddha while in a deep state of meditation. The sound of these syllables can induce beneficial energy or vibration. While reciting a mantra, we can concentrate on the sound of the mantra, on its meaning, or on the accompanying visualizations that our spiritual mentor has taught us. Prayers, on the other hand, were composed by great spiritual masters to help us develop constructive attitudes. They did this because sometimes we have difficulty differentiating between which attitudes and actions to practice, and which to abandon in our Dharma practice. Prayers express the essence of constructive mental states, and when we think about the meaning of the prayers, our minds are transformed into those attitudes. Because understanding the meaning of the prayers is important, they can be translated from one language to another. Although chanting prayers in Asian languages can be quite lovely and inspiring, we can also do them in our own language, because this facilitates our understanding. What does the mantra Om Mani Padme Hum mean? Om Mani Padme Hum is the mantra of the Buddha of Compassion, Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin, Canon, Chenrisig. The meaning of the entire path to enlightenment is contained in the six syllables of this mantra. Om refers to the body, speech, and mind of the Buddhas, which is what we want to attain by our practice. Mani means jewel and refers to all the method aspects of the path, the determination to be free from cyclic existence, compassion, generosity, ethics, patience, joyous effort, and so on. Peme, pronounced Peme by the Tibetans, means lotus and refers to the wisdom aspect of the path. By uniting both method and wisdom in a combined practice, we can purify our mind streams of all defilements and develop all of our potentials. Hum, sometimes written H-U-N-G, refers to the mind of all the Buddhas. Recitation of Om Mani Padme Hum is very effective for purifying the mind and developing compassion. We may recite it out loud or silently, and at any time. For example, if we are waiting in a queue, instead of getting impatient and angry, we can mentally recite this mantra and generate compassionate thoughts for those around us. There is the custom of giving an oral transmission of a mantra, which means a spiritual teacher recites it, and we either listen or repeat it after him or her. This transmits to us the energy of the lineage of practitioners who have used this mantra, and it makes our recitation of the mantra more powerful. However, even without receiving the oral transmission of Om Mani Padme Hum, we may recite it and receive benefit from its calming energy. What is merit? Isn't it selfish to do positive actions just to get merit, as if it were spiritual money? The English word merit doesn't convey the Buddhist connotation because it reminds us of getting gold stars in school and being rewarded because we did well. That is not the meaning intended here, and therefore, positive potential is a better translation of the Buddhist word. No one is rewarding us when we act constructively. Rather, we leave positive imprints or seeds on our mind streams, and when the necessary cooperative conditions are present, they will bear fruit. This isn't a physical seed or imprint, but an intangible one, a positive potential. Grasping at positive potential as if it were spiritual money is neither proper nor beneficial. If we do so, we are likely to quarrel with other people over who can make offerings first, or become jealous of others because they do more virtuous actions than we do. Such attitudes are certainly not beneficial. While we should take advantage of opportunities to create positive potential, we must do so to improve ourselves, to create the causes for happiness, and to help others, and not out of attachment or jealousy. Why must positive potential be dedicated? What should it be dedicated for? Dedicating our positive potential is important in order to prevent it from being destroyed by our anger or wrong views. Just as a steering wheel guides a car, dedication guides how our positive potential ripens. Dedicating for the most extensive and noble goals is best. If we do so, all the lesser results will naturally come. If we dedicate our positive potential, however small, toward the ultimate happiness and enlightenment of all sentient beings, this automatically includes dedicating for a good rebirth and for the happiness of our relatives and friends. Some people think, I have so little positive potential. If I dedicate it for the happiness of everyone, then I won't have any left for myself. This is incorrect. Dedicating our positive potential to others doesn't deprive us of its benefits. Rather, it expands the field of those who will receive benefit from our actions. While dedicating our positive potential for the benefit of all beings, we can still make special prayers for the happiness of particular people who are undergoing difficulties at that time. Can merit be transferred to deceased relatives or friends? Dedicating positive potential, merit, rather than transferring it, conveys the meaning better. We cannot transfer positive potential the way we can transfer the title to a piece of property or the way I can give you my car because you don't have one. Those who create the causes are the ones who experience the results. I cannot create the cause and have you experience the result because the imprint or seed of the action has been implanted on my mind stream, not yours. So if our deceased relatives and friends didn't act constructively while they were alive, we cannot create good karma and then give it to them. However, our prayers and offerings on their behalf can create the circumstances necessary for a positive action they created to bear fruit. A seed planted in a field needs the cooperative conditions of sunshine, water, and fertilizer to grow. Likewise, a seed or imprint of an action will ripen when all the cooperative conditions are present. If the deceased have done beneficial actions while they were alive, the additional positive potential we create by making offerings or engaging in virtuous actions, reciting and reading Dharma texts, making statues of the Buddha, contemplating love and compassion for all beings, and so forth, can help them. We can dedicate the positive potential from these actions for the benefit of the deceased, and this could help their own virtuous seeds to ripen.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Buddhism for Beginners, written by Thubten Chodron, foreword by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, performed by Gabra Zachman. Executive Producer, Susie Bright. Producer, Mike Charzik. Copyright 2001 by Thubten Chodron. Production copyright 2014 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.